With heightened geopolitical tensions in the Middle East and the far-reaching impacts this is having on energy markets around the world, Europe is once again facing tough questions around industrial policy, energy sovereignty, and security. It's a price and supply shock with potentially long-lasting effects. So how does Europe need to respond to ensure competitive advantage while decreasing reliance on fossil fuels? To provide insights into the situation, I'm joined by Anne Mettler, co-founder of Catalyze Europe. Anne highlights the need for localization and diversification, as well as policy reforms to scale innovation effectively. She also emphasizes the tipping point Europe is currently facing and how much is at stake. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Anne, thank you so much for joining me today. It seems like every time you and I speak, the geopolitical soup gets even more chunky. So I'm really pleased we have a chance just to catch up on what's happening and how this is really impacting Europe. So first question, with the war in the Middle East, what are some of the risks that you are seeing for Europe?
Yeah, thank you. It's an excellent question. And you're right. Every time we speak, you think the situation cannot get any worse. But then the next time we speak, it has actually gotten worse. And this is obviously a very serious situation right now. Europe is facing the second energy crisis in as little as 4 years. We're already witnessing inflation go up. The OECD came out today with new inflation figures, estimates of around 4%. That's a significant rise. While at the same time, of course, growth is going down and European growth was quite depressed to begin with. If I look back to 4 years ago, I think what is different this time, last time it was also a price shock. But this time around, it's also really very much a global supply shock, a global supply shock, right? Because we will see, I think, in the coming years, less imports of LNG. I heard that just today, Prime Minister Meloni is in Algeria to see if she can buy LNG from Algeria. Because obviously, following the bombings in Qatar, that supply, and I think Italy received about 30% of its LNG from Qatar, has now been cut off for the foreseeable future. So we're seeing in a very short period of time, a huge disruption. So this is very serious, and policymakers and businesses and citizens are right to be concerned.
Indeed. Before we delve into the specifics around the supply chain vulnerabilities, do you think lessons were actually learned after the Ukraine-Russia war?
Well, one wonders because, of course, take you back to the summer of 2022, the price of natural gas had risen eightfold. And our industry was basically in free fall. And so this was a very serious situation. What was one of the key responses was to actually double down on structurally more expensive LNG and very volatile LNG. This is after natural gas had been weaponized against us. So I understand that in the short term, policymakers were very concerned. We had to get through that first winter. So there was some understanding that, yes, of course, if we have supplies cut off from Russia, now we need to buy LNG. What was surprising to me was that this was not a short-term plan. This was really the long-term plan was to really go all in on LNG. I was mentioning this the other day in a speech that I gave, is because the German chancellor at the time, Olaf Scholz, he bragged about the new Deutschlandgeschwindigkeit, the new Germany speed was in how quickly Germany could build an LNG terminal in less than 12 months, right? So what really accelerated as the result of that crisis was that we doubled down on, as I said, structurally more expensive LNG, and we really accelerated the deployment of Chinese-made solar panels. But if I look at other sectors, for instance, the European wind industry almost collapsed in 2023. It needed basically an intervention by the European Commission in conjunction with the EIB and a 5 billion counter guarantee for the European wind industry to save that in 23. Then in 25, Northvolt went bankrupt, right? This was our battery champion. We didn't really manage to get any other clean technologies off the ground. There was a lot of hype about green hydrogen, as you know, that never really materialized. Also heat pumps, I would argue, have never really, you know, been as successful as we anticipated. So I don't think that the response to the 22 crisis was that good, to tell you the truth. And I often compare it to the response to the 1970s oil crisis, when Europe was really the champion in spearheading the development of wind and solar energy, which back in the day, those were real moonshots. You know, the idea that you could derive energy from wind and the sun, those were really radical ideas, but we made them happen, right? The other thing that happened was really the very significant increase in deployment of nuclear energy, particularly in places like France. And we need to be clear, that response was a very good response, right? It built out new sectors. It really got us off a fossil energy, which we don't have in Europe. So, you know, I compare those two. And I say, now that we're in a crisis again, instead of just looking forward, we really need to look backwards and say, what do we learn from how we responded in the past and how do we do it better going forward?
Absolutely. We need to be learning these lessons from history. And it feels like sometimes we're a little slow to do so. But Anne, as we sit here and have this conversation, what are some of the key structural supply chain vulnerabilities within Europe that you want to highlight that you think really need to be urgently addressed?
Well, the biggest issue that really needs to be addressed is sort of Europe's structural starting point, I would say. We don't have fossil energy, right? That's a fact. So, you know, that's the starting point. And here, actually, we are very comparable to China. China is in the same position. And I sometimes quote Deng Xiaoping, who said in 1992, the Middle East has oil, China has critical minerals. And they really made something out of that, right? So they really understood what is our competitive advantage. They knew that electrification was not only done for climate or was not even primarily done for climate. It was done for national security reasons and also with the objective to build out new sectors and conquer new markets. I think that was, I have to say, a very smart response, right? So here we are, Europe in 2026. We still import more than 50% of our energy in the form of fossil energy. Yeah, so more than 50%. It's important to understand that that figure of above 50% has not really been reduced in more than 20 years. So despite all the climate activism, et cetera, we continue to be extremely dependent on fossil energy. It's a fact. Then on the other hand, on the path towards electrification, we, of course, are very dependent on China, where we get all of our solar panels from, a lot of our batteries, a lot of the critical minerals, the permanent magnets that we need for our wind turbines. So very, very dependent on China. And I mean, honestly, we cannot import energy security in the form of fossil fuels, but we also cannot outsource energy security by buying everything from China. So Europe now really needs a very sort of comprehensive response that takes into account our structural starting point, which is We are deindustrializing. We continue to be very dependent on fossil fuels. So here for me, some of the priorities, if I were a policymaker, would be certainly localization, so more homegrown sources of energy. So definitely wind, solar, geothermal, also nuclear. At the same time, you know, we need to keep manufacturing in perspective. So we cannot, as I said, we cannot buy everything from elsewhere. We need to be able to produce some of this in Europe. So localization is one. The second is, for me, diversification. We cannot be overly reliant on any one source of energy, nor any one country. And right now, we are way too dependent. We will feel this in the coming months on oil and gas. Still, that's gonna be very difficult to maneuver. But we're also too dependent on China when it comes to our pathway towards electrification. The last thing I'll say that I think we need to keep in mind is sort of a trend towards I call it sometimes the decentralization of the energy system, because we obviously live in very volatile times, and we know that a first target in an armed conflict are always the refineries, the import terminal, the LNG terminals, etc. So there is a trend towards decentralizing the energy system. So, you know, maybe have more modular production of, let's say, synthetic fuels in different locations, at least for military use. So, you know, these would be some of the trends and some of the recommendations that I would have, that in this response, we need to do better than we've done in the past.
And you are not alone in these thoughts, I know that. But it seems like when we get hit by a crisis, it's always the short-term focus that comes to the fore. We see this kind of risk mitigation, looking at short-term risks. So are we going to see that again, where it's a case of focusing on supply rather than the longer-term goals of industrialization, competitiveness, energy sovereignty, and of course, decarbonization as well? What is the risk of that?
Well, I hope that this time around it will not be as short term as it was last time, because I think we're now learning the lesson that these short term solutions are no solutions at all. You know, so we really need better policy planning. And I say it as someone who has done policy planning, who has worked in the European Commission. We really need more comprehensive and better responses to all this. As I said, taking into account our starting point and say, what are our priorities? And the fact is that with now two wars on our doorstep, you know, you cannot deindustrialize with good conscience. I mean, the world is in a state of turmoil. And this is very dangerous if you can no longer produce things at home. And we're very, you know, I mean, in some sectors, we're very close to that. So I really believe that this time around, we need teams that take a longer perspective. Of course, I mean, it's in the nature of democracies to be sort of short term, right? I mean, I actually would like to write a book called How Planning for the Long Haul Became the Global Competitive Advantage. Because especially in energy, which, as you know, is you know, you really need a very long planning horizon. All these, you know, shifts and crises and different priorities, they don't play out well. So here, again, I mean, it pains me to say so, but we can take some inspiration from China, which really, you know, identifies the priorities, that is much better at systems thinking than we are. I mean, for me, it's such a disappointment. For instance, we had decades of quite, you know, significant consensus around renewables, you know, that we would that renewables would be basically the backbone of our energy transition. But if that was the case, why are we not the leaders in storage technologies? Did we really not know that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow? I just don't understand that we didn't see this years ago. The same with the build out of the grid. Why are these issues coming to the fore so very late? Because if you think about it, with every sort of quantum leap in the build out of renewables, we needed an accompanying quantum leap in the build out of the grid. Otherwise, this can't work. And this is where I'm just really surprised that on the side of policymaking, that we have been so slow to think in systems, that we have been very slow to anticipate these crises, that we could have been leaders in certain technologies. And so it on balance, I think it's been disappointing, and we need to do things better. One idea that I'm thinking about in the short term, if we do go towards this sort of short term, put out a fire type of a response, last time we subsidized fossil fuels to the tunes of hundreds of billions of euros, literally. I mean, it was bottomless. And this time around, I'm wondering whether for consumers, if there are subsidies, we should subsidize electricity. Because if electricity became cheaper, heat pumps and electric vehicles would become a lot more attractive. So if we do these kind of short-term measures, at least not do the same ones as last time and basically subsidize fossil energy. And of course, with this, subsidies of fossil energy, we need to take into account that the subsidies go to certain countries that we do not always want to be supportive of. So we need to be more strategic this time around.
I think what I'm hearing from you is just this need to really think differently, which obviously is difficult. I realize from a policymaker perspective, it's a slow moving machine. We know that. But think differently, think innovatively, for example, how you utilize subsidies. That is one example. And is innovation and innovative thinking perhaps a competitive advantage for Europe and something that we should be looking at tapping into now?
Of course. I mean, innovation is it's the only way for Europe, because we cannot compete on costs. So what are we competing on, right? So for us, the only way that we can be globally competitive is if we move up the economic value chain. And here, Europe actually has very good propensities. Innovation, frankly, is not the problem. I've been around the European innovation ecosystem for close to 3 decades. And I can tell you, we have amazing startups. We have amazing universities. We have good research, real skills in deep tech, etc. That's not the issue, And so innovation is the way. But what has been the missing link is, producing successful companies that can grow in this so-called single market, that find demand for these innovative products that they are producing, that can commercialize, that can internationalize. That's the missing link, So innovation, in the absence of being able to scale, just means you become like the world's incubator. It's not good policy. And it's really been painful to see that it has taken this long for Europe to understand that we basically have a problem around scaling up. We are underutilizing the single market. We are not guarding the access to that single market the way we should. We are very strict on subsidies while others are not. So we really need a comprehensive review of how we do policy. And I don't really see that yet, but it's never too late, I guess.
Do you think we'll see increased spending from the defense budget for spurring innovation? Because I actually saw an announcement from the European Commission today. I think it's 115 million euros for an agile program. Now, they're talking about defense innovation, but I think we might see a lot of the sort of defense budget going towards energy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I hope so, because if you think about it, energy is basically Europe's original vulnerability, right? For the reasons I just alluded to, primarily because we don't have fossil energy. So I would very much welcome if the defense establishment, if defense companies became more engaged in energy tech and clean tech. We need to recognize that many of these clean technologies are actually dual use. So, you know, they should qualify. What I have found, because I've made the rounds in defense circles, is that broadly speaking, energy is not first and foremost on their mind. So there's a lot of focus on procuring new, you know, weapons and tanks and fighter jets. But, you know, what will power these? You know, what are you going to use if we don't have fossil energy, right? What if we are cut off from kerosene and diesel, and how is this supposed to work? So we need to think along these lines. Same thing with drones. Everyone's talking about drones. But with our dependency and batteries, so drones fly with batteries. With our dependencies on China with batteries, are we really going to fly these European drones with Chinese batteries? You know, and what if we are cut off? So we really need to think this through before, you know, we're going to be spending hundreds of billions of euros on European rearmament. What you mentioned here, the 115 million euros, is really a drop in the bucket in the scheme of things, right? But it's very important that clean technologies are part of what we also consider defense tech, because absolutely, if you cannot fly your drones and if you cannot power your tank or your fighter jet, you know, you're going to be going nowhere. You will not be able to defend yourself. So I will do everything I can to make sure that clean technologies are part of that story. You need to remember that NATO countries have committed to spending 5% of their GDP on defense. This is very significant. 1.5% of that is supposed to be spent on what is called resilience. And all of these clean technologies should definitely qualify under this resilience criteria. So this is part of the reason, by the way, also why I co-founded this new organization, Catalyze Europe, because I want to make sure that clean technologies are not just viewed sort of from a climate perspective, but really also from a security and defense perspective, because they belong here. In a resource-poor geography like Europe, you know, these kind of concerns around where does our energy come from? How do we produce it? And where do we produce it? And do we have resilient supply chains becomes an existential matter.
I want to go back to that point that you made, Anne, about the fact that we are struggling to scale these innovations, and that companies are literally just kind of dropping off, unable to actually make the impact that they're intending to make. So Can you make some suggestions on how we can actually tackle this in a practical way?
Yeah. So, I mean, because I spent in my previous job, I spent almost 6 years helping clean tech companies scale in Europe. And this was, you need to remember, during the Green Deal and, you know, we were going to be the global leaders in clean tech, and it proved impossible. And I, having witnessed it up close, what I say is not only that Europe is sort of over-regulated, but we are over-governed. Because when you do clean tech, by definition, you're doing some piece of hardware. You need to build something, right? So then you're dealing sort of with the regional level. You need a permit. You need to build somewhere. So you're dealing with that. Then you need with then you deal with issues at the national level, be it taxation, be it labor law, be it all sorts of other regulations and compliance matters. And then in clean technologies, you are always dealing with a subsidy because these markets don't exist. So you need a subsidy to de-risk, to get projects underway. And then, of course, you have the pleasure of dealing with Brussels, with DG Competition, right? Which is no pleasure at all. So, you know, no startup can deal with this complexity. It's proving to be absolutely impossible and explains really that failure. So, you know, when we think about these matters, company building and, you know, the coherence of the single market need to be front and center from a civilian perspective. But let me come back to your previous point about the role that the military might be able to play. So, one of the problems is that to the extent that we build anything, we build one pilot. But one pilot, you know, doesn't make the difference. The technology is still going to be very expensive, right? And one of the things that the military does, it would never procure just one tank or one fighter jet. They always buy in bulk. And it's really through buying in bulk that you generate the volume, you scale, And every technology is on a learning curve. You accelerate the learning curve, you lower the cost curve. This is how things are done. And this is really my expectation, that as clean tech and energy moves more into the security and defense realm, that we really will have sort of military type approach to scaling, to really spending some money saying we're going to make this happen. And that could really be transformational. The other thing I will say is the military is has, you know, like a base will have, it's like a little city, right? They have, military has airplanes, they have cars, they have tanks, they have grids, they have houses. A lot of these technologies, they could deploy immediately because military is not subject to the same permitting as civilian outfits are. So the military could, in principle at least, could start deploying some of these technologies tomorrow without all the permitting and without all the, you know, the complex decision making that we face in the civilian world. So I really, really believe we ought to look in this, as we are now again in such an existential crisis, how we intersect with the security and defense establishment to really accelerate things and bring about better policy responses to what is a perennial threat and challenge.
Indeed. And it seems as if this is the new normal for us, which is obviously a little disturbing. And we need to be prepared. And this actually brings me to my last question. As we navigate these choppy waters, are you optimistic about how Europe is handling the situation, the geopolitical situation, in terms of securing industrial growth, energy sovereignty? Are you maybe feeling a little bit less optimistic? I realize you don't have a crystal ball, but it would be interesting to get your thoughts on how we're going to navigate this.
I'm not terribly optimistic. I'm a realist, and I know that Europe basically responds under pressure. Some people have said to me, how bad does this have to get before Europe moves? But I think we're pretty close. So I see certain aspects where I say these are promising signs. One of them was just launched. It's the Industrial Accelerator Act, which is looking to keep more production in Europe, is to give some preferential treatment, at least in strategic sectors and critical infrastructure for European companies. Another one is another element that I find positive is that this challenge of scaling, the inability to scale in Europe, has really now finally arrived in Brussels. We will have a Scale Up Europe Fund. We have a strategy. We have a commissioner. So, you know, there are some signs that we are understanding what the issues are. And what my own perspective is that I want to be part of the solution. I mean, I spent my entire life in and around public policy trying to make things better. Sometimes that means you have to be very critical, but I really want to be part of this team, Team Europe, that wants to improve things, because this is where I want to live. This is where I want my children to grow up. This is not just an economic matter. You know, this is a deeply personal matter. And in that sense, in the last couple of years, I have consistently sort of brought together what I call coalitions of the willing. One of them, as I believe you know, was called the Energy Resilience Leadership Group, which I launched in 2023 together with the CEO of Siemens Energy, where we basically looked at where do we use natural gas in buildings and power and in industry, and what are the emerging clean technologies that are ready to scale today to reduce the demand for natural gas. So we try to bring solutions. We try to, you know, broker collaborations between industry and startups. So there is much that anyone can do to change things. And this is what I would encourage everyone and of your listeners, is not just to sit back and hope that a policy will miraculously improve. We're all part of the solution. And I am committed to be trying to be part of that solution, which is why I did a lot of things in my life, but now I'm co-founding this new organization because I really believe we need such an organization like Catalyze Europe, which really wants to look at clean energy from a completely different perspective. As I said before, security and resilience and competitiveness and industrial policy. So I never give up. I'm always, in the game, and I want to change things for the better. And I want to use this crisis to really turn things around.
Well, Anne, we fully support your endeavors to fight the good fight and continue doing so in Brussels. But for now, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your insights. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Pamela.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Logg, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.